This is the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
Hello, everyone. My name is Anthony Froggatt, and I'm a senior research fellow at Chatham House. And I'm joined here today by Matt Hind, who is the EU Affairs Chief for National Grid in Brussels, and with Caroline Kuzemko, who is from the University of Warwick and a co-partner on a project that we've been working on, Brexit and the implications on EU and energy climate policy. We've invited Matt along because we've just released a report which looked at Brexit and looked at scenarios for a clean and secure energy future in a new world. And Matt very kindly came along to many of our events and was incredibly insightful. So we thought it would be useful to share with you all some of our thoughts and those of Matt at this particularly important time. But obviously, we are in a period of intense focus on the energy sector in Europe and globally as a result of the war in Ukraine and the consequential increase in energy prices. But also, we're all too aware of the ongoing problems around climate change, the increasing frequency of high-intensity weather events, and the ongoing certainty about the science and the need for really rapid decarbonisation. So we'd just like to talk through these issues with Matt and Caroline. And so maybe, Matt, if I could open up with you, really. We're aware of the intense problem with energy in EU and, of course, in particular in Ukraine. But do you think we're on track? Do you think the EU is on track to meeting the energy needs in this winter and probably next winter as well?
Thanks, Anthony, and thanks for the invite to be here. I mean, where are we in terms of this winter? So if you look at what's happened in Europe since the 24th of February, there's been a lot of activity from the European Commission and the European Council. There's been various programmes such as REPowerEU, which has sought to kind of reduce exposure to Russian gas. And there's been the target for the filling of European gas storage, which was originally, I think, 80% for the 1st of November. That was met by the 1st of September. And I haven't checked it in the last couple of days, but I think it's above 90% now. And it's also, as you can see by looking out the window, it's been a fairly warm autumn so far. And that's also helped to reduce gas demand. And in addition to that, across Europe, we've seen kind of reduced energy usage, which has been both a policy measure and a consequence of high prices. So with all of that together, going into the winter, things look manageable. You wouldn't want to guarantee anything at this point in time, but we could be in a worse position. And I think it's fair to say that most observers look at this winter as potentially easier to deal with than next winter, because the issue is next year, of course, is refilling the gas storage after we've used it over the course of winter 22-23. And that's in the context of, in 2021, receiving, I think, 155 billion cubic meters of gas from the Russians. Now, it's fairly clear that that will not be available next year for refilling of European gas storages. So I think this winter is looking relatively manageable, depending on weather. Next year is another question.
It's quite foreboding, isn't it, in terms of the potential consequences? I mean, Caroline, I mean, what's your view? Do you share a view for the EU, if you have one, but also for the UK? Where do you think we are? Has the UK undertaken similar measures in terms of filling up stores, saved energy, diversified supplies, etc.?
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. And again, also, as Matt said, it's great to be on this podcast together. I'll just say quickly before I go on to the UK, just on the EU, its policies and targets as part of REPowerEU, but also all the other packages that it's announced around this, are incredibly ambitious. And it's looking at pretty much transforming energy systems in a tighter time frame than I think anyone has attempted up until now. So whilst I agree actually with Matt that this winter, or maybe that's just relative to what we were all thinking a sort of a few months ago, this winter's looking like maybe okay, depending on the weather, bigger concerns around next winter. I would just want us all to really focus in on this question of implementation, because clearly it's one thing to have these incredibly ambitious policies, but it's really another thing to be able to successfully implement them. So I think that is going to be a big question for the EU. And then also just for the EU, but this also stands for the UK as well to a great extent, is just to take slightly better account of the global consequences of all this incredible amount of policy change that's going on in the EU. Because, you know, as there's been sort of various articles about this and various blogs in sort of FT, but also in UKIRC pages about the consequences of those policy changes being somewhat negative, actually, in terms of knock-on effects in energy for other parts of the world. So that's around access to LNG in particular, affordability of energy. Some countries like Pakistan, for example, had been very much encouraged to switch from coal to gas for its electricity. It was doing so, but then it wasn't able to get hold of LNG because it was the tankers were turning around and going to Europe. So I just also think in the run-up to COP27, and obviously there'll be a COP28 as well, bearing in mind these sort of tensions between actions in the EU and actually then what it means for the rest of the world is probably an important thing to start trying to get our heads around. For the UK, I mean, who knows? There's been so much political change. It's a little bit difficult to get our heads around where we are. I mean, I know that behind the sort of the politics, there's all sorts of regulatory and more down-to-earth everyday discussions going on, and that Matt is obviously very much part of. But the broader politics of it has been a little bit difficult. So, you know, clearly we have a British energy security strategy. Clearly, expansion of renewables is a big part of that, and of nuclear, although there's a lot more questions about whether nuclear will happen or not. And, you know, it's unlikely to fix any near-term problems this winter or next winter or for another 10 or 15 winters to come. So I think the calls in the UK are for there to be much greater emphasis on energy efficiency and demand-side response. And I did notice, of course, National Grid's demand flexibility service that it has just announced in order to try and get peak demand down in particular. And I thought that was a really positive first step. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Great. Yeah. And I think some of the peak demand managements have also been introduced within the EU. In some ways, what I've heard from both of you is lots of new policies, lots of new measures, some clearer objectives than others, but overall a desire to rapidly move away from fossil fuels. But Matt, are we seeing, obviously, the series that we've been working on is looking at Brexit. Do you think that we've seen any material shifts in the relationship between the EU and the UK in light of the war in Ukraine? And what sort of are those, and what might the important things be?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, it was always foreseen under the Trade and Cooperation Agreement that there would be a deep relationship on energy between the UK and the EU. And that's because, to all intents and purposes, the UK is still physically part of the European energy market. We're connected by two gas pipelines to continental Europe, plus pipelines to the Republic of Ireland. And we've got, next year, we'll have six electricity interconnectors between us and continental Europe. So we're physically still part of the market. So that was all foreseen under the TCA. Now, clearly, there's been some kind of quite tense politics since we left the transition period at the end of 2020. And we've perhaps not made as much progress on developing new mechanisms as we perhaps would have liked to have done. Efficient electricity trading, TSO relationships, North Sea cooperation. I think probably Ukraine has brought that to the fore in two ways. One is the kind of the short-term use of the UK's gas transmission system for bringing in some gas into Northern Europe via the three LNG terminals in the UK. And ever since, well, practically since February, the two UK interconnectors, IUK and BBL, have been running at full capacity into the European system to help Europe restock. Now, I think in total, it's something around 15% of total European gas demand, gas storage, has come via the UK. Now, just as a comparison, the EU spent a lot of time over the last 10, 15 years building up the Southern Gas Corridor from Azerbaijan, which is an important piece of diversification as well. But I think the UK system has brought more in than that Southern Gas Corridor over the last year. So I think that's just indicative of how important that, and so also to say that if there's a cold winter, for example, we will need some gas coming in from Europe via those interconnectors. And I think that's a good indication of the interdependence of the UK and the EU when it comes to gas, for example. In the medium term, how do we get out of this situation? Part of it is certainly the deployment of renewables, and particularly from a UK perspective, the deployment of renewables in the North Sea. And cooperation between the UK and the EU there is really important, both in terms of kind of efficient use of the seabed, in terms of maritime spatial planning for the amount of infrastructure we're going to build, but also in terms of being able to build cross-border projects that minimize the amount of infrastructure as far as possible and reduce costs. So those things in the medium term will reduce our demand for external gas supplies. And I think that's become particularly clear over the last few months.
And maybe I'll just follow up. There was, in terms of the Prague summit, so the European political community, was there developments there that's worth highlighting?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's a very interesting thing. So within the TCA energy title, there was a section that talked about the North Sea Energy Cooperation Platform. And the North Sea Energy Cooperation Platform is something that was set up by the North Sea countries with the engagement of the European Commission about a decade ago. And it's effectively the political forum for discussing how we develop the North Sea as a renewables kind of superpower area, really. And obviously, with Brexit, we left that. But within the TCA, there was articles that allowed the development of a new relationship between the UK and the North Sea Energy Cooperation Platform. That's been being developed by officials in BEIS and in the Commission for the last year. But in Prague, the Prime Minister at the time, Liz Truss, raised that issue, talking to the Czech presidency, but it was also raised by President Macron, by Prime Minister Rutte of the Netherlands. And it was really a positive message about the need for UK-EU cooperation in this space. And that's very noticeable, because I think if it's agreed, that will be one of the first kind of standalone agreements that the UK and the EU have developed since Brexit to develop a bit more kind of in-depth cooperation. And as I say, that cooperation is essential in the North Sea because, well, if you look at the aggregated targets for wind in the North Sea, we have a 50 gigawatt target in the UK, and the cumulative targets for the European sectors of the North Sea is 76 gigawatts, and that's for 2030. So the target is for 2030, 126 gigawatts in the North Sea. That's an enormous amount of infrastructure. And we need to be able to coordinate that offshore. We need to be, as I say, we need to be able to work on maritime spatial planning together. We need to be able to develop the regulatory system so we can build these projects together with our respective partners in Norway, in Denmark, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in France. And to do that, we need kind of forums where we can have these political and regulatory discussions after Brexit. And the North Sea Energy Cooperation is a really good example of that. It's not finalized yet, but I think those of us in the industry are hoping it will be signed off by the end of the year.
That sounds very encouraging. Thanks, Matt. I mean, Caroline, what's your view?
Matt's made some really good points there about the degree to which, although politically, the UK may no longer see itself as being in the EU, geographically, the fact remains that the UK is you know, right between Ireland and the rest of the EU. So it is actually physically, geographically in the EU in some respects still. And the strength of the relationship on energy, but also on climate change, has meant that the UK is interconnected. And so making the most of that within a world which is geopolitically less secure, is geopolitically maybe somewhat different than it was in 2016 when the decision was taken to leave the EU. Making use of that seems to be practically incredibly important. And I wonder if both sides are beginning to recognise that a little bit more. So the EU had a sort of a big line on no cherry picking. So it was, the line was, sure, you know, we can have these relationships on trade, on energy, on climate, whatever, if you will take certain rules. If you won't take the rules, then it's going to be a hard Brexit. And so that was always the hard line. But I wonder if that decision to allow the UK to rejoin the North Sea's energy cooperation actually hints at allowing a tiny little bit of cherry picking. It's interesting, isn't it? It's just a sort of an idea that's come into my mind because this mood music has changed, and there have been compromises on the UK side as well. So the sort of the holding back of the voting on the Northern Ireland Protocol in the House of Lords seems to me to have allowed some political space.
Well, it goes back to this point. I think Ukraine has shown that we need to cooperate. And there's two things there, really. One is the longer term on gas. I mean, there will be a role for gas in the system for at least in the medium term. So LNG terminals are remain important. And one of the things that has been quite interesting is the rapid development of floating LNG terminals in Germany, for example, where I think there's five on the cards now. Now, as Caroline said earlier on, that's going to have a really interesting impact on the global LNG market. Because the problem for us as Europe is that whilst we can build up greater amounts of LNG capacity, there's a lot in the Iberian Peninsula, for example, although you can't get it across the Pyrenees at the moment. And obviously, there's a lot in the UK, which historically, you know, it tends to run at 25% capacity, and it's running a lot heavier now. The problem is, in terms of the global G system, there's not actually that much LNG. And one of the reasons that Europe's been able to attract quite a lot this year is because of the continuing lockdowns in China, which has reduced demand in China. Now, presumably, that's going to end next year, and so LNG prices will go up, potentially. And we don't really see new LNG projects on coming on stream until 25. So I think it will continue to be a tight market. LNG will continue to be really important for Europe. And after that, you're then starting to look at where does hydrogen fit into this? And once again, hydrogen, you would want it to be a tradable commodity. And there are projects already between the UK and the EU on the hydrogen backbone and things like that. So I think in terms of if you're looking at molecules, be it natural gas or hydrogen, there will continue to be the need for cooperation there and at least compatible regulatory systems so we can continue to trade with each other. On the electricity side, as I say, I mean, it's that 2030 target's enormous and has real potential for offsetting gas demands. But going beyond that, the cumulative targets in the EU, for example, are, I think it's 189 gigawatts for 2040 in the North Sea and 260 in 2050. In the UK, it's 75, but potentially going beyond that. So you're looking at hundreds of gigawatts of renewable capacity in the North Sea that are envisioned for 2050. And long-term cooperation on that to make sure that we are able to send that electricity where it's needed via lots of interconnection is really important. Not to mention, I mean, one of the stated aims of the previous government was for us to become a net electricity exporter by 2040. And that's also a commercial issue for the UK as well. The ability to sell into the rest of the European energy market.
Yeah, Matt, that's really interesting. I mean, what I guess we're seeing is a different form of cooperation. So moving away from trade in fossil fuels and the what we've seen over the last 6 months is the real importance of the UK to the EU system, to one where as we decarbonize, we move into different potential vectors in terms of hydrogen, but also increased importance of electricity, that trade and cooperation actually needs to increase in the years ahead. So yeah, let's hope that the move music is to move in this direction and increase regulatory, technological development, and I guess skills cooperation in the years ahead.
I mean, on that point, it's if green hydrogen becomes a very large scale, commercially viable technology, then you would envisage a situation where we're all producing lots of green hydrogen with the excess renewables that hundreds of gigawatts of offshore wind in the North Sea produces. And then that's tradable commodity as well. So I think there's quite a lot of potential for that kind of cooperation.
And absolutely essential in terms of the balancing of the grid with variable renewables, the ability to flex power and molecules in different directions will be absolutely key.
So one of the big technologies that my company, Grid, and our kind of interconnector business, National Grid Ventures, is looking at is something called multipurpose interconnectors, where you attach wind farms in the middle of the North Sea to interconnectors. So they can be used either for interconnection when the wind's not blowing, or they can be producing into potentially two different markets. So we're starting off with projects that connect the Netherlands and the UK, or Belgium and the UK, with wind farms in the sea. But that's kind of almost the first stage. In the long term, we'd be looking at a meshed North Sea grid, which would have a lot of renewable capacity in the middle of the sea, potentially connected to multiple markets. But for that, the benefits of that are you absolutely maximize the amount of infrastructure you're putting into the sea. You reduce the amount of cables. You reduce the amount of landing points onshore. But to do that, you have to have cooperation. And as I say, if you go back to these big numbers, 50 gigawatts in the UK sectors, 76 gigawatts in the EU sectors. All of that power has got to come onshore. So what you can do to minimize the amount of infrastructure that's coming onshore is great. And that's a challenge that all of us around the edges of the North Sea face. But also, if you can make those connections in a way that the power goes to where it's needed at each point, that also makes it much more efficient, as Caroline said, for the balancing. So there's real potential there, but you do need to be able to build these cross-border projects on that basis. And that needs us, as I say, to have you know, at least compatible regulation that we can kind of bolt together.
Well, some optimism. Yeah, I mean, I think the logic is clear. Maybe the political logjam may have been removed or may at least be diminished. But I guess what we all look to is probably more short term in terms of what happens this winter and next. And we hope that the energy remains available and affordable. Otherwise, we are in a serious crisis in terms of, yeah, the sort of economics of Europe as a whole. So on that cheery note, I think I'll draw us to an end. But I do think we see lots of opportunities, increased cooperation, and hopefully an accelerated decarbonisation and more secure system in the UK and the EU. So Matt, Caroline, it's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKERC, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.